Hello, and welcome to episode number 3 of Orcs in the Basement, an RPG video game podcast. Coming at you pre-recorded from Portland, Oregon, although I'd rather be at the Dragon Quest Carnival in Yokohama. I'm your host and traveling merchant for this episode, Jay Ortega. In today's low-key episode, we will be covering some thoughts on the state of emulation, followed by reflections on tactical RPG / visual novel Digimon Survive, which is coming up on its 2-year anniversary this week. But before all that, let's take a look at the quest board. A slime appears. This summer, slimes are indeed going to be appearing in the city of Yokohama, about half an hour south of downtown Tokyo, as the city hosts a Dragon Quest Carnival in Yokohama Minato Mirai event. Serving as venues will be Landmark Plaza and Mark, two neighboring entertainment complexes in Yokohama's Minato Mirai Harbor District. Both will have gigantic public art displays, slime positioned atop a Dragon Quest world map style floor, and background for immersive photos. The festivities will include a slime painting activity where you can purchase an unglazed ceramic slime, paint in it whatever colors you like, and take it home with you. You can read more at Sora News 24. Also, kudos to Blue Sky Dragon Quest account, heck yeah, Metal Slimes, who you can find on Blue Sky as at metalslimes.bsky.social for more Dragon Quest news. The Dragon Quest love continues. I've recently been pondering on whether I should do a Dragon Quest 11 playthrough, and after much thought, I think I'm going to start doing 30 to 40 minute episodes a la Let's Play on YouTube. I think I'll record the first 2 acts and then live stream act 3. For more, follow on YouTube at Moko's Gummy, also linked in the show notes. Next, Nintendo reveals its mysterious horror game, and it's not what fans expected. According to Kotaku's Willa Rowe, a week after releasing a teaser for a new horror game, seemingly called Emio, Nintendo has pulled back the curtain on the mysterious project with a full reveal. Turns out, it isn't exactly what the creepy first trailer made it out to be, and is instead a new entry in the long-term Famicom Detective Club series. The game is officially titled Emio, The Smiling Man, Famicom Detective Club, and is coming next month on August 29th. Finally, Rose City Comic Con is coming to Portland September 6th through the 8th. Passes have been on sale, and I am excited for all the panels and programs happening this year. I still need to buy my pass, but I am determined to go this year, so hopefully look forward to a Rose City Comic Con episode in September. Segment on emulation. So recently my feed has been filled with posts regarding the emulation community, along with some cool looking devices that are optimal for emulating some classic retro games. Some examples of this are the Amber NIC. I've just seen it everywhere. I also heard about it in podcasts, so I'm wondering if I should look more into that device, or if I'm just happy with how emulation works on my smartphone. As someone who just recently has gotten into emulation, I'm actually pretty happy with the way accessibility for some otherwise very hard to find or expensive to purchase games has been, and which has made it possible for many to delve deeper into the roots of our favorite franchises. While the emulation community has always been at the center of some of my favorite streams and YouTube retrospectives, it was not until the Delta app came to iOS a few months back that I started engaging more with news coming out about emulation. Delta app really opened my eyes. Like, I always been an iPhone user, which in itself I know is something that is not accessible to everyone, certainly because of the price. But for me, it's just been what works the best. So I've just continued to stay with Apple. So seeing it on iOS has been really helpful, at least for me. And This has led me to read a little bit more. So I'm planning on doing like little segments on the history of emulation, where it comes from, the ethics around it. I think it's so interesting that it started off as something that was highly considered as sketchy for a long time. And now we've seen a push towards really valuing it as something that seeks to maintain the longevity of games. So we'll get into that a little bit here, but I will, since it's something that is so complex and nuanced, I'd rather tackle it one bit at a time. So today we're just going to go over one of the earliest examples of emulation in a very small, easy to digest portion of the podcast. So dating as far back as 1994, with multiple standalone arcade games, emulators only capable of emulating a single game, games like Rigger, Gauntlet, Ghosts and Goblins, Bomb Jack, Asteroids, Mr. Do, Series Pac-Man, etc., to name a few. The community would continue to grow as emulators would pop up for future consoles like the Commodore 64 in the early 90s, Atari 2600 in 1995, and just a few years later, the SNES. According to the Emulation General Wiki, just like the NES, the SNES emulation history is quite fuzzy, but there's evidence that SNES emulators existed as early as 1994. VSMC was released in 1994 and could run a select few homebrew ROMs. Apparently, it was updated a few times after it initially released, and later versions could run some commercial games, including Final Fantasy II. Super Pasofami, or SPW, Super Pasofani for Windows, developed by the author of Pasofami, was released sometime in 1996. Very little information is available about this emulator aside from the reports that version 1.4 deleted some people's Windows directories. The SNES was one of the first SNES emulators that could emulate sound. It later merged with NLK SNES to become NLKE. NLK SNES was one of the fastest SNES emulators. Though it lacked sound emulation, it later merged with ESNES to become NLKE. NLKE is a successor of ESNES and LK SNES and contains both speed and sound. And finally, we have SNES 9X, which was a merged effort of SNES 96 and SNES 97. Both released sometime in 1996 through 1997. Oh, we also have ZSNES, which was the first released on October 14, 1997. So that's just a timeline, some context as to when the SNES emulator started popping up. And as you can see, there's a long list of different ones. As a fan of the SNES era JRPGs, I've really enjoyed picking up on its history and being able to pair that with context of gameplay of now hard to find titles. It's made my appreciation of gaming more complete. It's also interesting to see the medium of emulation go from being perceived as sketchy and underground to an institution that is pioneering freedom to access of all information surrounding game history and the preservation of classic game titles. Jump forward to today, and Delta just released update 1.6, which according to Nintendo Life, this update introduces the ability to seamlessly switch between iPad and iPhone, improves DS performance, the ability to insert GBA games into DS dual slot, menu button gestures, and improvements to the app's save state features. Growing up, I always was a generation or two behind, getting hand-me-downs from older relatives that had purchased the latest console for themselves. I would often get their old console in the mail inside a clothing detergent box. At least that's how I remember getting my first game console. The Super Nintendo, along with a copy of Super Metroid and Super Mario World. Funny enough, the battery needed to store memory was dead on arrival, and so I never got to see most games to completion. So being brought up with a fondness for retro games, it's been heartening to be able to go back to a game like Super Metroid and be able to play it through to the end. Like I mentioned before, emulation history is long and nuanced, so I will try to break it down in segments in future episodes. Early, we had a little taste of what that looked like. A lot of it can be kind of nuanced, like I mentioned, so if there's anything out there Any sources or articles you'd like me to look into for research into this topic, feel free to share. Otherwise, I'll be doing my own research, trying to find ways to kind of break it down in more accessible ways. Also, I'm always happy to read your questions and letters during the show. So if you're so inclined, you can email me at orcsinthebasement@gmail.com for future mailbag episodes. If you're a fan of the show and would like to follow on social media, you can find me on Blue Sky at orcsinthebasement.bsky.social. I have to say that I'm really enjoying Blue Sky Social a lot better as an alternative to Twitter X. The community there seems to foster a healthy and creative place for folks like myself. I highly recommend it. If you're looking to leave Twitter for a new community, Blue Sky has been really worth it for me. Now, onward to Digimon Survive. I first played Digimon Survive almost 2 years to the date, soon after release. Digimon Survive is a visual novel with tactical role-playing game elements, developed by Hyde and published by Bandai Namco Entertainment for Nintendo Switch, PlayStation 4, Windows, and Xbox One. My history with Digimon series goes deep. Like many other people my age, I grew up watching Digimon on Saturday mornings, coming at a time in the middle of my growing fascination with Pokemon trading cards, and soon after acquiring Pokemon Yellow, Pikachu edition, I was in the prime for another monster collecting fandom. Shout out to Monster Rancher, y'all were robbed from achieving critical success like Digimon and Pokemon, I have to say. There's some games that have come out for Monster Rancher, but not to the same level as either Digimon or Pokemon. Anyway, since then, I have played games like Digimon World 1 on the PlayStation, and then Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth and Hacker's Memory. So I was excited when in 2018, Digimon Survive was announced. From early announcements, we could tell that the game was going to be much darker in tone. Not totally unlike previous games and seasons of Digimon that historically have had more mature story beats compared to other animated franchises. However, this game certainly had the vibe of a more sinister plot device. Despite being announced in 2018, we wouldn't get the game until 4 years later in July of 2022. This was largely due to development woes early on. As development progressed, producer Kazumasa Habu realized that their original budget and smaller studio was inadequate to achieve his vision, resulting in game being redeveloped from scratch and switched to a different game engine altogether. This, along with the impact of COVID-19 pandemic, resulted in the game being delayed from a previously announced 2019 release date. Digimon Survive is a visual novel with tactical role-playing elements. With social trees that allow you to build bonds with the others, stranded players, a feature that plays a pivotal role in how the story progresses. Not knowing this early on led me to have one of the bad endings at the end, while witnessing several team members be unalived throughout. According to DigimonFandom.com, player choices influence the direction of the story, including the Digimon's Digievolution process. Multiple playthroughs can result in different paths and different Digievolutions. The game will feature multiple endings, and should wrong choices be made, characters will be unalived. The game is split into multiple types of gameplay, such as drama parts, search action, and free battle. During drama parts, the game proceeds as a text adventure to tell the story. In search actions, the player searches for a way to survive. In free action, the player chooses where to go and who to talk to in a limited window of time. During free battle, the players can enter certain areas to train their Digimon and collect items. Some of the list of characters include Takuma Momosuka, Minoru Hinata, Aoi Shibuya, Saki Kimishima, Ryo Tominaga, Shuji Kayama, Kaito Shinonome, Miu Shinonome, and others that are on a historical studies extracurricular activity camp during spring break. On the second day, Takuma, Minoru, and Aoi visit a famous local temple to investigate the legend of the beast gods, also known as Komonogami, where a festival to celebrate them will take place. As they explore, they come across Koromon, then hear screaming. Koromon and the group run to the source and find their classmates being attacked by other Digimon. Koromon digivolves to Agumon and scares Digimon away. It is at this point that Takuma and others discover that they are in another world. Despite the game getting very mid reviews, I consider it one of my favorite Digimon games to date. At the time, this was my introduction to the tactical RPGs, a subgenre that I continue to love with games like Triangle Strategy and Tactics Ogre. Square's Robert Ramsey felt that the character dynamics, intricate artwork, and intriguing story as it highlights, but felt that its point-and-click-based exploration sections were slow but bearable at best, frustratingly tedious at worst, and felt that its combat was stunted. Writing, it never branches out from the basics, with Digivolution being the only aspect that adds genuine spice to proceedings. Despite getting a bad ending, I was pretty satisfied with the game's story and really appreciated the sharp, creative turn the franchise took in embracing a more mature and dark tone with the story, while also changing up the formula which we often associate with Digimon World games. I didn't play it a second time immediately after completing, mainly because I wanted to save a second playthrough for a future date. Once you roll credits, the game does offer New Game Plus content, and it is meant to be replayed. Also, I didn't mention this before, but the artwork for this game is the best I've seen for the franchise in general, both when it comes to the characters in the environment. I have to say that as a visual novel, this game's design makes it so immersive, along with a score composed by Tomoki Miyoshi. Now that we are coming close to 2 years since release, I do have plans of picking it up and giving it another playthrough to hopefully achieve a better ending or more complete retrospective on the game. I love this game, but if you're still on the fence, I would wait for it to go on sale, as it often does, because it's at set a standard price of $59.99 American dollars, and it's a steep one. Even though there are hours upon hours of content, I found this game on sales previously, so I would just wait for the right moment. Fans often complain about the game not getting enough advertisements as other games, but what a lot of reviewers put into perspective is that this is not a AAA game, so while we're expecting some Pokemon level outreach and promotion, this game was not at that same category, so therefore it did not warrant as much advertisement. Although looking now at the Steam reviews, they're all mostly positive there, so that is often mainly what I look at myself to really get a sense of whether the game is worth purchasing or not. For me, I really value the perspective of other players, so I think Steam tends to be really dominated by the reviews of people just like myself actually playing the game, because otherwise the game scored really low on Metacritic and IGN and other game review sites. Something that I heard, I haven't solidified this yet, but while doing research, I saw that this game, in order to avoid spoilers, was really not given ahead of time to a lot of people. So I think adding that kind of salt to the wounds of people who are in charge of reviewing the games could have swayed the reviews one way or the other. But I really like this game, and it's one of my favorites, I have to say, for the year 2022. It was my first experience with like a survival horror type visual novel, and then add the tactical JRPG elements. I was in heaven. I thought that was such a unique experience, and would really recommend it to people who are also passionate about games that are willing to take risks and try something new. I think that this was such a breath of fresh air, especially for the duds that we've seen come from companies like the Pokemon Company. I feel like this taking a leap towards a darker narrative and having a blend of different genres and play styles really made it exciting for me. And I thought the length was really good. I really was on pins and needles trying to figure out, you know, how my choices would really implicate the safety of the friends I've made throughout the game. So with that said, I do want to say that, of course, and I'll try to put this in early in the show, trigger warnings for, you know, death and loss of loved ones. I feel like maybe an added obstacle that this game faced when it came out is it was really coming at the peak of the pandemic. So a lot of people maybe didn't have an appetite for this darker style of a narrative. Also, comparing it to something like Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth, I feel like the story and total experience going from beginning to end in Digimon Survive seems a lot more cohesive. In my experience, while I've been playing Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth, I'm still not finished with that game, and I've placed in like hundreds upon hundreds of hours, which is great if you're looking for a longer RPG style game, but I think that that game is a little bit on the longer side, and I really liked this where it was feasible for me to complete and it didn't feel too short and it didn't feel too long, and it has the option of going back and replaying. There's a lot of replayability because, like I said, the narrative is very strongly based on the choices you make throughout the game, how your conversations go, who you decide to put attention to, all that. So because of that, I really, really appreciate it. Not that I want to knock on Digimon Cyber Sleuth. I think it's another great example of just combining two different game styles into one in a way that is cohesive and makes sense with the story. I really liked it. I just had no regard to how long it would be when I first started. So maybe like 150 hours in, I kind of lost sight of the plot for a little bit. But I think I am going to get back to it and do a more formal review. Maybe even start it again. We'll see. But I think that that game's ability to kind of foster and grow your Digimon, try different Digievolutions based on like the skill tree, all that is what has existed within the Digimon game franchise for a while. So taking that and introducing it to like the mystery detective style gameplay was really successful. I did like the story in that one. I just think that it did go all over the place, but I'm not gonna knock it because of that. I think it made it interesting and unique, and you were more so there for the gameplay. I think the game was very self-aware and had some very like comedic and light scenes that poked fun at itself throughout the game. So for those reasons, I think it's another top tier Digimon game, but I'm just noting now as they're moving forward, these are the things that are working. This is the direction I want to see the games go in, and just being a little bit more critical than I would normally. So with that said, Digimon Survive, Digimon Cyber Sleuth are both very great games, and I'm really excited to see the future of the franchise, see where they take it. I similarly with like the shows, I thought Digimon Ghost Game was tonally a lot darker than its predecessors. And because of those reasons, I am really grateful that the series is also thinking about people who've been following Digimon for a long time. So kind of having a story that matures with the fan base is really cool. While also like being accessible to new players is something that I really admire them for. Outside of ports or games becoming available in different consoles, I haven't really heard news regarding the future of Digimon games. So I haven't heard of a new project or anything. I know that Digimon Survive took a long time, but I'm hoping that they were also able to be working on a different project on the side or soon after, but we'll see. I get very excited when a new title comes out, so if I hear any news, I will be sure to share on the podcast and in social media. So feel free to ask any questions, especially dedicated to Digimon if you like. And also let me know if I am missing anything, if there's another exciting project within this universe that you'd like me to hear about. Now we're getting ready to head back to camp. So here's some loot for your journey back. Matching today's dark and mature tone, I want to recommend a book by Etomori. I read it soon after finishing the film by the same name, directed by Keiichi Hara. And the summary goes a little bit like this. "Congratulations, you've won the lottery," shouts the angel Prapura to a formless soul. The soul hasn't been kicked out of the cycle of rebirth just yet. He's been given a second chance. He must recall the biggest mistake of his past life while on homestay in the body of 14-year-old Makoto Kobayashi, who has just committed unaliving. It looks like Makoto doesn't have a single friend, and his family don't seem to care about him at all. But as the soul begins to live Makoto's life on his own terms, he grows closer to the family and the people around him, and sees their true colors more clearly, shedding light on Makoto's misunderstandings. This is one of my favorite novels, and with a stellar anime adaptation, I highly recommend this book if you're in the proper mindset to take it in. Deeply reflective with slice of life elements, the novel can also be accessed for free on the Libby app, often provided by your local public library. Also, with that said, shout out to libraries. They are amazing. A lot of them are part of what's making gaming history stay alive. Not at my current local public library, but I know a lot of libraries within the nation have added to their collection video games. So it's great to see some of these titles archived and have a way to sustain themselves and have continuity. With that, thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of Orcs in the Basement. Join us next week for a discussion on Pikmin 4, the perfect summer game, and surprisingly, an RPG too. Hope you'll have a great week, and thank you for tuning in. Nos vemos!